From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the Detroit Bankruptcy Reorganization Plan. What's ahead for the city, its creditors, and retirees?
This is one of those things where you have to be an optimist and a realist, or a pessimist and someone who is living in the past.
A new play takes us to those five dark days in Detroit in July 1967.
People just exploded. But you could say from the white perspective, that's a riot. From the black perspective, that's a rebellion.
And a look at Michigan's women farmers.
Girls were put off farming when they were children. They were encouraged to marry farmers to be the help or the support network. And that rendered them really invisible and closed doors for a lot of women.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and thank you so much for joining us on this Tuesday. Well, we've almost all done it. You might have even done it today, like I did. Made a purchase online. Have you ever wondered why you have to pay sales tax on online purchases from some retailers, say Target, but not others like Amazon? Well, there's new legislation in Lansing that might change all of that. We find out more on today's show. And then, close your eyes. Now, picture a farmer. What comes to mind? My guess is a man. But more and more women are raising crops now in Michigan. We'll look at what's behind the rise in female farmers later this hour. But first, it has been 5 days now since Detroit Emergency Manager Kevin Orr released the Bankruptcy Reorganization Blueprint, the one that maps out a way to wipe out billions in debt, spend over $500 million in tearing down abandoned buildings, and invest $1 billion to improve city services. Now that all stakeholders have had a chance to digest this blueprint, the battle lines are being drawn. Let's look at what's ahead for all sides as we welcome Detroit Free Press columnist Rochelle Riley. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much.
Well, the headline in the Free Press the day after the restructuring plan was released read, "Detroit Plan divvies up pain and promise." And I'm wondering, do you think that the promise is going to be worth the pain?
Well, you know, this is one of those things where you have to be an optimist and a realist, or a pessimist and someone who is living in the past. I think that the shame of it is what has to happen to fix things. This is a very emotional as it is economic, because you're talking about major changes to people's lives. They're talking about the biggest thing is the pensions.
Sure.
They're talking about, you know, pension cuts, 34% for general service city workers and 10% for police, former police officers and firefighters.
Who don't get Social Security, we have to remember.
You know, who don't get Social Security, who did the job that, you know, like teachers, that we're not going to do. They go do these heroic and angelic jobs. They retire with the promise that this is what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And that promise is being broken. But I can tell you there are things that happened through the years that somebody should have said, you know what, we better pay closer attention. I'll tell you just a couple of things from our series, How Detroit Went Broke, which is one of the best things ever done in American journalism, because it broke down issues that people don't really understand into understandable bites. For instance, revenue in Detroit fell 40% from 1962 to 2012. You can't have a 40% drop in revenue and not adjust for that, not make amends for that, not deal with that. In addition to that, the total assessed value of Detroit property, which is sort of what you determine, you know, to see if a city can pay its bills and if its tax base is okay, fell 77% in the past 50 years. You cannot do that and not make major changes. But this is the part that, unfortunately, you look at pensioners and people who know that when I'm not working anymore, I have to make sure this works.
Right.
You have to pay attention. I explained it to somebody. I said, it's like counting on your bank to send you checks, and you don't even drive by to see if the bank is still open. And all of a sudden, you go by and the bank isn't there. They handed out about $1 billion in bonuses from the city's two pension funds from 1985 to 2008. We're just talking about over 23 years. That money could have shored up funds and prevented the city from filing for bankruptcy, and most of it came in the form of a 13th check.
That 13th check.
Let's see. Everybody gets paid monthly, 12 months a year. It's just the American way. Except in Detroit, you'd get a 13th check that nobody said, oh, at some point we have to make sure we have the money to keep doing that. Mm-hmm. So there were lots of things that people ignored, and the chickens came home to roost. And now they're roosting on the shoulders of these pensioners, many of whom are too old to work, cannot deal with some of these cuts. The average pension is only $19,000, And they're going to be expected to lose either a third of their income, or if you're a former police or firefighter, a tenth of your income.
I think a lot of attention, I think, right, should go to the folks who are running these pension funds.
Absolutely. And, you know, people are looking at the pension funds. They have been for some time. Mm-hmm. You know, there are all types of looks and investigations to make sure, you know, that things were not done improperly. But we've written stories about some of the mm-hmm. things that have happened, some of the, you know.
Starting with the 13th check.
Starting with the 13th mm-hmm. check. But in addition, just some of the other things, the way the pension boards behaved, you know, the types mm-hmm. of things they did, the types of trips they took. They need to look at all of that. But that won't help Detroit, because you have to stay focused on the future. And the bottom line is, at this point, what can you do? They can fight to not have bankruptcy mm-hmm. and then figure out how to make this work, or they can get to a clean slate. We're so far from this being done, you know, now that they've presented this plan,
right.
And, you know, they did the two things. The first thing was the plan of adjustment, uh-huh. which shows, you know, the creditors and their debt and what the city is going to pay. And a lot of the creditors are like, I'm not taking pennies on the dollar. I gave you my money in good faith. And then the disclosure statement that shows the city government's future, what it should look like.
Right.
This is when the lights are on and when the police and fire work and the officers come when you call and all of the – and the blight removal, you
buildings
know, half a billion dollars to get rid of some of this stuff that, you know, makes the city look so bad.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, improve city services, a better city, some place that you can get people to move and then stay when they have kids, which gets to the schools that is not even a part of this plan.
Right.
Or do nothing.
So it's been crystal clear since – Kevin Orr rode into town. There is no money in the piggy bank. And there are so many causes and people to blame for that spread out over decades. But Kevin Orr isn't one of them. He wasn't the one cutting the 13th check, or he wasn't the one engineering the credit swaps deal that now the city's claiming was illegal. That was Kilpatrick's team. So I get, you know, why scream and howl when there's nothing in the pot?
You know, it's human nature. You know, people, first of all, don't adapt well to change, period. Mm. But then they don't adapt to change that they know is going to make their lives worse. All they're thinking is, I am nearing the end of my life, and the city said this is what I'd be able to do, and this is what I counted on, and now I've been lied to. The interesting thing is, you can't blame Kevin Orr, and you can't blame Coleman Young, which a lot of people did. He's the only mayor since 1950 to run government without debt.
Wow.
Which means,
right.
A, it's yeah. possible, and B, somebody should have kept doing it.
If you just joined us, we're speaking with Detroit Free Press columnist Rochelle Riley, kind of looking over the bankruptcy reorganization blueprint that was submitted by Detroit Emergency Manager Kevin Orr. And let's talk more about these pensioners. Should the governor and legislators step up, Rochelle, do you think, to back the state constitution that protects these retirees and make these pensions whole?
Well, that's one of the many, many areas of litigation that's going to happen. And it's the only one that I think the state should be required to do. Mm. You know, you can't do this separation of state and federal and you don't tell our state what to do. If here's a challenge to your constitution.
Your state constitution.
Your state constitution, yeah. And you're ignoring it. The biggest battles I thought would be around the DIA. I think this is going to be a bigger battle. This is something that was guaranteed. This was an issue that was so important that they wrote it into the Constitution. So, yes, I think if the governor and the legislature are willing to give $350 million to save art at the DIA, then they need to do what they need to do to help the pensioners. I don't know that they won't be able to take any cut or have life as usual. Mm. There's no such thing as a 13th check. There's no bonuses. All of that is taken care of. They're going to have to adjust and make sure that the number of people working for city government is a number that can be afforded.
What do you say, though, to convince legislators who will say, you know, tax dollars from my constituents, let's just say in Escanaba, should not have to be used to clean up the mess in Detroit?
Well, people are saying that now about mm-hmm. the DIA deal, which, mm-hmm. as you know, calls for $350 million
the grand
of state
bargain.
Tax money
yeah.
for this you know, scheme, this mm-hmm. plan to move money into the pension funds and spin off the mm-hmm. DIA as an independent. Okay, well, that's tax dollars. And mm-hmm. people are actually talking about that like, okay, we can do this.
But that isn't going to come without strings attached, is it?
There may be strings, but it's still tax dollars. Mm-hmm. I think that if you are willing, this is what I would say. Okay, this is the state constitution. This is the one literally from the Upper Peninsula to Detroit, from Grand Rapids to – this is the one that covers everybody. If you don't want it to apply for people in Detroit, then why should it apply for people anywhere else?
Mm-hmm.
I think that at some point either your constitution means something or it doesn't.
When you look at the timetable that Judge Stephen Rhodes has set that mm-hmm. would resolve this bankruptcy by September and perhaps see Kevin Orr riding out of town by September, what concerns you the most?
That's never going to happen. I appreciate that everybody has the timetable they're working on, but unless he plans to just stop working in the middle of it, this litigation is not guaranteed to end this summer. You know, it's like, okay, people are filing lawsuits everywhere, and you're just sort of declaring they're all going to be done. I'm going home to my wife. I don't know that that is logical. I think it's optimistic. Mm-hmm. I think it would be great for this to be done. But there are two things that people forget. Governor Snyder has already said on several occasions that there will still be some type of oversight. So Kevin Orr being gone does not mean the end mm-hmm. of some type of management, state management and oversight. And the second thing is, you know, these lawsuits could go the other way. I mean, two of the things that have been interesting is, oh, wait a minute. So Detroit didn't try to borrow money, didn't try to make changes to the casino revenue. But now Kevin Orr is doing that. Why couldn't the city do that? And maybe, you know, its leaders did not quite understand to do that. But now that you've sort of shown the path, why not do bankruptcy and go do those things? You know, if you're going to be making cuts to the pension anyway, why can't you do all of these things without bankruptcy? There's all types of questions being asked by people who either don't think the bankruptcy is real, don't think the bankruptcy is necessary, or don't want any emergency management. And there's that argument, too, where people are still saying that Kevin Orr should never have come.
Well, and under the law, can't city council say, see ya, come September?
Well, come September, they have the authority to do that. But that doesn't mean that the state, again, can't let whatever that new oversight is kick in right then, and there's still somebody telling them what to do. It just won't be the emergency manager.
So what gives you the most hope? Let's end on that note.
There's two things, and this is going to sound so petty. Well, not petty, but for me, turning the lights on, you know, a city that operates in the dark, that its neighborhoods, which must survive and must have attention, are in the dark. That's where the drug deals go on. That's where the shootings are happening. That's where the crime is. People who are talking in the suburbs and say, oh, I don't know if I want to go down to Detroit because it's dangerous. If you're going to Comerica Park or to Ford Field, there's nothing that's going to happen to you. You know, look at crime reports. The crime reports are in the neighborhoods. Yeah. They're at gas stations. They're where people are shooting people in the dark. Turning the lights on is the most important. What they're going to do with the lighting authority and what they do with police and fire is the most important thing in this city. When you do that and you fix the schools, everything else can come.
Detroit Free Press columnist Rochelle Riley. It's always a pleasure, Rochelle. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. The face of farming in America and here in Michigan is changing. More and more often, that farmer raising crops or tending to a dairy herd or raising bees is a woman. As women move from a supporting role to a starring role on Michigan's farms, how is this changing agriculture? Joining me for this conversation is the owner and operator of Cloverland Apiary and Farm on Michigan's Keweenaw Peninsula, Sue Raker. Welcome.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. And we're joined by Wynn Wright. Wynn's a professor in community sustainability and sociology at Michigan State University. Wynn, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Sue, I'm going to put your life story into a movie pitch. An Army vet. Listen to this. An Army vet, Vietnam and Bosnia, worked on ranches in Montana, fought forest fires, worked as a forester, winds up running a 120-acre farm on the Keweenaw, raising bees and selling organic honey, hay, seasonal vegetables, and garlic. I have to say, I would watch that movie to see how this woman wound up as a Michigan farmer in Calumet. So with all you've done in your life, and there's even more than what I've listed, why farming?
I always wanted to be a farmer. I don't know if it's genetic. I'm starting to think it might be with people, but I've wanted to be a farmer since I was 2 years old. And I took my doll collection and traded them down the street to a young man who now is in interior decorating and traded me his barn and farm animals that he'd been given at Christmas, and we both were happy.
Now, you had a really intriguing conversation with your mother, Sue, when you were young. Tell us what happened when you told her you might want to be a farmer.
Oh, my gosh. My mother was not from a farm family. She was an established family down in Niles, one of my favorite places for agriculture in the state, by the way. And I kept saying, year after year, they'd say, now what do you want to do? The school would ask us, parents would ask, and I kept saying, I'm going to be a farmer. Now, my father, who was from a farm family, said, no, you got to think of something else. It's horrible. You have to work too hard. You can't do it. My mother said, well, Susanna, you'd better go to Michigan State. You can marry a farmer. And I said, I don't want to marry one. I want to be one. Because even by my young age, I just, you know, I'd figured out that a lot of the farm wives were busy in the house, and the only time they were needed was when, it was time for a problem to be resolved with fencing or livestock that had gotten out or something like that. And the incredible analysis that's needed, plus picking and choosing every single day and sometimes many times during a day, wasn't there. It wasn't happening. But anyway, I wanted to be a farmer.
And here you are, and you have this starring role on your farm, not a supporting role. Winwright, does Sue's story track with what you hear from other women who are farming in Michigan?
Actually, I think her whole life story, really, we could put it in a larger context and say, I'm sure she's a wonderful, very unique individual, but there are a lot of things that aren't very unique about Sue's story. Girls were put off farming when they were children. They were encouraged to marry farmers, to be the help or the support network, and that rendered them really invisible and closed doors for a lot of women. Some of those doors have been opened in the 70s and 80s. Some of this has to do with the inroads that the feminist movement has made in helping us to rethink what is appropriate women's work. So there are a lot of ways in which her story reflects mainstream structural transformations that have been going on in the last 30 or 40 years.
And do you find that most of the women who are choosing to be farmers in Michigan, like Sue, come from a family of farmers?
Actually, it's hard to answer that question. There's no data. So I'm just going to say my anecdotal experience working in the College of Agriculture and Natural Resources at MSU suggests that, no, that's not the case. That perhaps it might be for women of a certain generation, but the young students coming to agriculture today, the young women, I should say, are coming being motivated by a different set of values. They usually come to agriculture and production through an environmental consciousness.
Yeah.
So they may not have had any, let's say, practical on-farm cultural immersion like Sue did in agriculture production.
If you look at history and if you look at any of the arts, women were incredible hunter-gatherer assistants. They were agricultural thousands of years ago. If there was anything that was genetic, it was that women were acquiring water, tending crops. You look at Native American mythology, it's very, very pronounced that women were busy watching the crops and having the children be around, but working on a lot of that while the men were at the periphery of camps or settlements. And so, I don't want to say, yes, we're wired for this, but there is a history out there beyond people sailing across the sea, coming to this continent and starting to grab land and grow stuff on it. I think that there's something very sensible about environmental awareness, and the more chemistry and the more soil science, and the more you take, you go, I have an issue with that. As you see things that you don't agree with, or you wonder, is there more to organic farming than Rodale's magazines? Why do all the guys walk around and spit and whittle and jump on the tractors? I felt like I'd turned a corner in Montana when I went out one spring to talk with folks in western Montana about hiring me to help with calving or lambing or doing some other things. And these folks said, several of the ranchers said to me, you know, I'm really glad to talk to a woman. I always hire women because they're more concentrated toward what's happening and doing a good job instead of having somebody watch them and get into town to hide out in a bar. So that was I thought, well, great. So they're not freaking out that a woman came to their door.
If you've just joined me, we're talking about women as farmers, and I'm speaking with farmer Sue Raker. She owns and operates Cloverland Apiary and Farm on Michigan's Keweenaw Peninsula, and she's joined by Wynn Wright, who's a professor in community sustainability and sociology at Michigan State University. I'll get the thoughts of both of you. Does farming in 2014 call for a different skill set than, say, 50 years ago, and are these skills a woman might excel in?
I would say both yes and no. My knowledge about mechanics, welding, electricity is not great, but it's good. It's good enough But on the other hand, the cost of combines, a lot of machinery that's required, in particularly in places, I would say, where it could be afforded with a longer season. We have about a reliable 90-day frost-free season up here. On the other hand, listening to my uncles, listening to my cousin, Karen Raker, who farms right along the Ohio River Valley, I would say there are certain things that are just givens, and you find yourself reading every moment, every evening, every time you get a chance, you're going to be reading agriculture stuff. That just happens, and it's a plus, and you should do it. But as far as what's happening with getting up early, doing things, and when your friends say, well, meet us in town for lunch, we want to hear about, and you go, no, I can't.
What's that?
Well, why is that, Sue? Because we are combining oats. Can't you do it next Tuesday? No. The answer is no, I can't. Agriculture comes first. But if you are focused on agriculture and you realize what a unique career it is, and if you can be the person that's so happy that day in the fall that's cold when you start in the morning and you go sit on your south-facing steps in the evening and crunch on an apple and just let yourself sigh and relax, if that feels good to you, then it's going to pay off. If I used to tell friends that would say something, and I still tell young women that I meet, if you can dream it, you can make it happen. I mean, I never thought I would be able to score high on a certified organic farm. I never thought I would be working on a project with bees and localizing bees that were brought over from Russia, from the area around Lake Baikal, and have been established in the United States. There just are incredible opportunities, and lots of young women now, as Wynn pointed out, have the education and the vision. Farming is not something you get stuck doing. It's something that's an incredible opportunity.
When this, it strikes me that as you see young students coming in to your classes at Michigan State University, do these young women have that perspective and that total commitment to what it will take to make a farm successful?
Well, as I said, one of the things that they don't have any experience in, it's incredibly valuable, as Sue knows, is the cultural immersion in the lifestyle of farming. Mm. And they're in for a few surprises once they leave and try to roll up their sleeves and make some of the theory that they've learned in the classroom apply in a practical setting. So I don't want to judge them as individuals, but I have heard story after story that they find that sort of sacrifice very difficult. And it is a sacrifice for a lot of young people. And older people, for everyone in agriculture. I did want to just mention a bit to touch on the points that Sue was making about how men and women might farm differently. I think there's some really interesting things that are going on. I can't agree more with what she said, but to some degree, the ways in which men and women are similar or different has to do with the type of farming they're engaged in. There are some demands that consumers are increasingly making on the food system for healthy, local, ecologically responsible foods, what we might put under the umbrella of sustainable agriculture, that does lend itself very well to skills that women have been given the opportunity to cultivate. And I don't want to suggest that they're inherent or essential part of being a female, but in many cases, many women who are farmers now have spent much of their career in other careers, and they're coming back to agriculture in their 50s as a sort of second chapter, second career, or perhaps their spouse has died and they've inherited the land, and now they're the sole decision maker for the land, so they've turned to farming. The skills that they've developed in the public sector are allowing them in ways that men aren't so great at developing new markets, at being personable and friendly at the local farmer's market, for example, for being able to strike up a conversation, to sell and market their products, to brand and put an image on the value-added products that they have created on the farm. So in some ways, the new demands that consumers are expecting of agriculture align to some degree much better with women's skill set than men's, because it requires a much more social component rather than simply a technical set of skills.
Good point.
I'm wondering, do we have any sense as far as how many women are farming in Michigan? I did see one statistic that said about 27% of America's 3 million farmers are women. They're either running farms alone or they're working with husbands or others. Do we have any sense of what that figure might be for Michigan?
There are about 56,000 farmers in Michigan as of the last census, which was in 2007. Mm-hmm. So we're due for new data actually any day now. So of those 56,000 farmers, 8,200, or around 15%, are female.
Okay.
Those are people who are solely responsible for decision making. Mm-hmm. There might be others, of course, involved in agriculture that are also working with a husband, a brother, as a partner of some sort, and share decision-making responsibility. The interesting difference, however, is two-thirds of these Michigan farm women operate farms under 50 acres. It doesn't take a lot of space to create a vegetable CSA or produce vegetables for a farmer's market, right? Yeah. But, of course, you're not going to make very much money if you're relying on 50 acres and you're planting that in conventional corn or soybeans.
No.
It strikes me, Wynn, that for these young women who are coming into agriculture classes at Michigan State and elsewhere, it's one of the few opportunities where, honestly, women will get paid the same amount as a man. That can't be said for many other occupations.
Well, I'm not so sure about that. In theory, perhaps, but most Michigan farm women earn less than $10,000 a year in annual farm sales.
Wow.
5% of women operators had annual agricultural sales of over $100,000. Now, that's agriculture sales. That doesn't mean that they're pocketing that.
Mm.
Typically, the rule of thumb is maybe they'll see a third of the sales that will go into their pocket, you know, as far as farm income. Because women are farming differently, they're positioning themselves to earn different amounts of money. And they're also still impeded through cultural practices of land transfer, land mm-hmm. inheritance practices that often favor men and certainly have historically. Getting access to land is the big hurdle, particularly
mm-hmm.
for young people, men or women, who don't come from a farm background.
That's
so increasingly, with the value of conventional commodities being quite robust in the past few years, land rental prices have skyrocketed. That means there's fierce competition, and those established farmers in the community have aggressive tactics for making sure they control that land or get access to it and keep access to it. This is not a way for a young beginning farmer to break into farming, which is one of the interesting things, again, that set women apart a little bit. They're much more likely to want to engage in a more cooperative or communal type of experience.
Yes.
And Sue talked about this a lot. She used the word fun and enjoyment and satisfaction when she was just telling some of her experiences. And that's another thing that sets some of these young farmers apart, and not just women, but you see this time and time again, a desire not just for a business, but to think about an integrated life that marries a productive life that can create income, but also one that can be lived in harmony, perhaps with one's values about nature, animal welfare, and family and community, this sort of reintegration of the household, the farm, and the community as a robust, dynamic place.
Well, a fascinating conversation with both of you, and we've really enjoyed it. And I have to say, we all want to be sitting on that step in the fall afternoon eating an apple with you, Sue Raker, owner and operator of Cloverland Apiary and Farm in Calumet on Michigan's Keweenaw Peninsula. And Sue is joined by Wynn Wright, who's a professor in Community Sustainability and Sociology at Michigan State University. Pleasure to talk with both of you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Thanks
to
a lot.
Women out there. Thank you, Wynn.
You too, Sue. Good to talk.
Thank you.
And after we got off the phone with Sue and Wynn, we got the latest census numbers just out, and they found that the number of women farmers in the U.S. held steady from 2007 to 2012. There are now 7,409 primary female farm operators in Michigan. Welcome back to Stateside. Michigan's new state treasurer, Kevin Clinton, is calling on Michigan residents, or calling for Michigan residents, to pay the state's 6% sales tax on all of your internet purchases. Right now, online shoppers in the state do not have to pay the sales tax to companies without stores in Michigan, like Amazon or Overstock.com. There are currently bills afoot in the state legislature known as Main Street Fairness legislation that would change that. So will you soon have to pay sales tax on that Amazon purchase? Chad Livengood joins us now to try and answer the question. Chad, of course, Lansing reporter for the Detroit News. Welcome, Chad.
Thanks for having me.
So quickly explain for us just what this Main Street Fairness legislation is. What would it do?
What the legislation seeks to do is to redefine what a company's nexus is, and that's essentially a legal term for physical presence in the state. And the reason why Amazon and Overstock.com get away with not having to collect Michigan sales tax is because they don't have a physical store or warehouse in Michigan. If you've ever shopped at like Target's website, you will find that they charge the Michigan sales tax because Target has stores in Michigan.
Sure.
And so they're trying to close this loophole that that has been essentially existent as long as we've had internet sales purchases for at least 16 years now. And the problem is that they run into the political issue of this looks like a tax increase because it's collecting it would be enforcing collection of a tax that is currently not enforced. Now, there is a way to voluntarily on your income tax, as people are filling out their income tax forms, to voluntarily declare that the purchases they made on Amazon.com.
Oh, yeah, we're all doing that, right?
I actually did it this year myself. I got to that point in the TurboTax software, and it asked you that. And so I pulled up my Amazon .com account and figured out that I bought $190 of baby stuff in 2013.
Okay.
So I remitted the $11 and 40 some odd cents, I believe, onto my state income tax return. But
more honest than most folks, I think.
More honest, mostly so I could make this example on your show.
Sure.
But other than that, it seems like it was worth $11. But it's so rare. I mean, the state through the first 8 months of last year had about $5 million that was voluntarily remitted, and they were estimating that there was $290 million that was going uncollected. I mean, it's a big chunk of change when it comes to the state budget, and that's money that goes to schools and communities.
What do other states do with this? How have other states handled this, Chad?
It varies. Some states have actually passed laws cracking down on it. They've struck deals individually with Amazon to collect the. It varies across the map, and that's one of the problems and one of the arguments why Michigan should not take this on is that they should wait for Congress to take this on and pass a law that essentially applies to all the land. The problem with that politically is that we have to wait around for Congress to make a decision. We all might be in 6 feet under, so that's not necessarily always the greatest solution to things. But some states have done it, and some states haven't. And then the other issue is that some states don't have a sales tax. So it doesn't really apply to them. I mean, I used to live in Delaware, and they're tax-free Delaware, as they like to always tout themselves as. And so it's not going to – whatever Congress does or even what individual states do, it's not going to apply evenly across the map. But that's just the nature of our uneven tax structure in this country.
So as we were saying, it's Kevin Clinton, our state treasurer, calling for the change. But how much power does he really have in this? Because isn't this really a legislative matter?
Well, for several years now, the Treasury Department has essentially been neutral about this subject. This bill has been in the legislature for several sessions now, and the Treasury Department has continued to report, the amount of money that's going uncollected, but really remain fairly neutral in the whole subject. And for the state treasurer this morning to come out and say that he thinks this is good tax policy, and essentially he was speaking the language of the so-called Main Street retailers who say that this has put them at a disadvantage. He even used an example that Dan Marshall, the president of Marshall Music, commonly uses when he's advocating for this subject, is that people will come into Marshall Music stores, and there's about a half dozen of them across the state,
mm-hmm.
and they will look at an item on the shelf. And then they will look it up on Amazon on their phone and price compare, and then they'll walk right out. Or they said they've seen people actually sit there and order the item. And Kevin Clinton brought that up today in a House Appropriations Subcommittee, and he said he thinks it's terrible that someone could walk into a store, look at an item, pull out their iPhone, order it, pay less, mm-hmm. and then move on.
After talking to a sales clerk and taking up their time.
Gain some advice on this trumpet or whatever.
I have heard that from other retailers, small businessmen who say, I can't believe it. They'll look at a piece of jewelry that I have and go, okay, thanks, and walk out the door.
Take a photo of it.
Yeah, precisely.
Yep.
And you also just think, as you said, that it sounds like about the better part of about $250 million is slipping through the collective fingers of the state in uncollected money. So who would be against this?
Well, some Republicans and conservative groups have come out against it. The Americans for Prosperity has said this is a tax increase, even though it legally you're supposed to declare this tax, by the most accounts, this is just essentially a tax that's not being collected or not being enforced. And then there is a general concern that we've essentially allowed for the better part of almost two decades, people to shop sales tax free on the internet, and we're going to have to change that. It's kind of like maybe forcing people to subscribe to a newspaper after almost two decades of getting for free online. So we've conditioned the public, and then if you take that away, there's obviously the fear of backlash. And so the idea that this will get tackled this year in election year is probably unlikely. But the fact that the state treasurer is coming out in favor of it does show there's some force behind it.
Chad, do you think this is something that smacks of some lame duck action once everybody's going to be scooting home?
Well, that might be a good time to do it. I mean, there's going to be a lot of things that'll be probably on the lame duck session agenda come December. And when you have a third of the House members will be termed out, and a half dozen senators will be termed out. There might be the votes to take this on in lame duck.
And not have to deal with the emails and phone calls from folks who like to buy their baby supplies on Amazon.com.
That's what I use it for.
Chad Livengood, Lansing reporter for the Detroit News. It's always a pleasure. Thank you, Chad.
Thank you.
It was just after midnight, July 25th, 1967. The Detroit riots were at their peak. National Guard troops had seized the annex of the Algiers Motel, searching for snipers. 2 hours later, police left the Algiers. They found no snipers, but they left behind them the bodies of three black youths. That infamous Algiers Motel incident is the subject of a play by Detroiter Mercy Lee Jenkins. It's called Spirit of Detroit, a play about the 67 riot rebellion. It will soon be presented at the Charles H. Wright Museum of African American History. And joining me now is Bob Smith from the museum. Very good to have you with us, Bob. Thank you.
Certainly glad to be here.
And also joining us is the director of the play, Kate Mendeloff. She's a theater professor and director from the University of Michigan Residential College. Welcome back to Stateside, Kate.
Thank you.
Robert, give us a sense of what we know and what we don't know about what happened at the Algiers Motel.
Well, there's no question that the full investigation of that incident was never done properly. And we will probably never know exactly what happened. We do know that three young men were left dead. We certainly know that justice was not served, that no one was ever held accountable for those deaths, that there could not have been any way that with National Guardsmen, with policemen, that the young men themselves would have been responsible for their own deaths. Mm-hmm. So that it was certainly, in many ways, plain and simple murder.
And the play, Kate, Spirit of Detroit, how does the playwright tell us the story of what happened that night?
The playwright tells the story through the eyes of and the experiences of two young people who are both, they've just graduated from high school. And so they're in their, 17, 18 years mm-hmm. old. And they both come from the east side of Detroit. A white girl named Lucy, who's from Indian Village, so an upper middle class white family, and Anthony, who is from the same neighborhood but from a middle class black family. They went to elementary school together, and then they meet at the Algiers by, you know, just by accident. They're both escaping the riot, finding a safe place to be. And part of what, at least in the play, and I think also in John Hersey's book, which is the closest thing we get to a thorough investigation of the events, he points out that it was the mixed race mingling of white women and black men that brought about a lot of the violence, that the police and guard were reacting against that. And the young women were molested by the police, which we see in the play. The young men were threatened, and ultimately three of them died.
And how much I know Hersey's book is – I read one review that said really this incident deserves a better book, that it was felt that there were deficiencies in the way John Hersey approached writing the story, and there were deficiencies. Do we know categorically that women were molested? And we certainly know three young men died.
Well, probably what the book does not provide is sort of a historical context mm-hmm. for understanding Detroit's racial attitudes and politics. We look at the history of Detroit, particularly the police department, and the history of African Americans and Southern whites coming to Detroit. There were two major waves of migration into Detroit, first during the 1900s, early 1900s, 1920s. And there's a lot of discussion about the migration of African Americans to Detroit during that period to work in the automotive plants. But also at that same time, many whites primarily from Kentucky and Tennessee came to Detroit, both in that first wave but also in the second wave pre-World War II. And many the police department strategically hired Southern whites to be policemen. And so you have a whole culture of racial attitudes. And so when you look at, and we all know race in relationship to sexual issues is really the tipping point. So, and the same thing with the National Guard. So certainly there would have been policemen in National Guards who had these attitudes inside that room at the time. And there was even efforts, there was an understanding in Detroit that the police department was racist. And even by people in the top administration, there were even attempts to address the problems of the Detroit police. And so that was something that probably Hersey did not really address and make people understand.
So. If you just joined us, we were speaking with Bob Smith. He's with the Charles H. Wright Museum of African American History, and he's joined by director Kate Mendeloff, and she's from the University of Michigan Residential College. And student actors from U of M are presenting a play by Detroiter Mercy Lee Jenkins. It's called Spirit of Detroit, and it's about the Algiers Motel incident during the 1967 riot and rebellion. And I want to focus on, Kate, if I will, that term, a play about the 67 riot/rebellion. We understand commonly that what happened in Detroit between July 23rd and July 27th, 1967, is generally labeled a riot. Why does the playwright use that word rebellion?
Well, I think what's really significant is exactly, I mean, working off of what Bob just said about this brewing hostility as kind of festering. It was described really well in Mark Benelli's new book by a Detroit resident as a kettle, the nodal point when a kettle boils and when it finally makes the noise. The boiling was going on all the time. And there was
so that blind pig raid just was the final
straw. It flicked
it.
Yes, exactly. And not just that, but one of my colleagues who's a geographer pointed out that it was the hottest summer. And those days were the hottest days of the summer. So you had people in the street who couldn't be at home. There was no air conditioning. And, you know, out on the street, restless, uncomfortable. And then yet another example of police brutality. And people just exploded. But you could say from the white perspective, that's a riot. From the black perspective, that's a rebellion. So I think it's really important to include the rebellion aspect mm-hmm. because that's a very strong theme in the play. One of the strengths of the play, I think, is that it really does represent a more kind of measured view of the situation because you have a young white woman, but she's an educated and very racially aware person. And you have a young man who's grown up in a middle-class neighborhood and has interacted with whites. And so you have their dialogue putting this in context. But also the whole play is framed 40 years later when they meet at an art gallery in Detroit commemorating these events. And he is an artist, a visual artist. And she's become a writer. And they examine, we go back in time and relive those events.
From the perspective of four decades.
Right, exactly. We go back, you know, again at the end to what they're left with. And also what Detroit is today.
Mm-hmm.
And the play was actually written in about 7 years ago. So it's set in 2007. So it's not Detroit of today. Mm-hmm. It doesn't include the current issues in Detroit. But it's about bridging that gap, trying to heal the wounds at least between those two people and to see how Detroit can rise again, that spirit of Detroit.
The play is called Spirit of Detroit, a play about the 67 Riot Rebellion. It'll be performed by students from the University of Michigan under the direction of my guest, Kate Mandeloff, and it will be at the Charles H. Wright Museum of African American History. Performances on Friday the 28th, Saturday, March 1st, and Sunday, March 2nd. And also joining Kate was Bob Smith with the Charles Wright Museum of African American History. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you for having us.
And a reminder, the Spirit of Detroit will be presented at the Wright Museum this Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. There'll be question and answer sessions with the director and the playwright after every performance. And on Sunday, March 2nd, they will be joined by leading members of Detroit's clergy, including Dr. Charles Adams. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Bob Scon. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Chris Hattlesey, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, and Claire Tennisketter. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks for listening, and let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.